Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are getting an update on COVID. More than 167 million people in the U.S. are fully vaccinated, but that is still only about half of the total population. Infectious disease experts say a lot more people need to get vaccinated in order to prevent more variants from spreading. The U.S. is now averaging over 100,000 new cases every day, and many hospitals in states like Texas, Florida, and Indiana are filled with unvaccinated patients. Children represent 18% of weekly reported cases. Child cases have steadily increased since the beginning of July. And here is what we know about the Delta variant. Unvaccinated people are at a much higher risk of getting infected. Only less than 5% of the people being hospitalized and dying are fully vaccinated. That is less than 5%. A lot more young people are getting sick with Delta compared with earlier variants. Delta may also be causing people to get sicker faster. The vaccine is the best way to protect yourself and others, and wearing masks in crowded settings and indoor spaces is also the best way to protect yourself and others. So if you have any questions about the variant, the surge, vaccine boosters, we're just hearing that the Biden administration is expected to announce that most people who've been vaccinated will need a booster 8 months after being vaccinated. Any questions at all about where we are right now, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us. We're at Your Call Radio. Joining us now is Dr. Bob Watker, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Watker previously served as president of the Society of Hospital Medicine and chair of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Dr. Watker has been a leading voice during the pandemic. Hi, Dr. Watker. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rose. Good to talk to you.
Well, Dr. Watker, I have been following, like so many other people have been following your long Twitter threads over the past year and a half. You have been so involved in COVID and watching everything that's happened over the last year and a half. How do you assess where we are right now?
I'm pretty surprised. 2 months ago, things were looking pretty rosy certly in the Bay Area and really around the country. Because we had kind of a magical moment after surge three when vaccination rates were going up and we'd not yet seen the ravages of Delta. We were dealing with prior viruses and prior variants that were less apt to spread. So we were in pretty good shape. And I think Delta has surprised almost all of us who have been following this. It's just nastier, more apt to spread, and is in many ways outrunning the level of vaccinations that we have. So like everybody, I'm disappointed at where we are. I thought we'd be in a better place. And I'm also disappointed, obviously, by the politicization of this pandemic, which has been a problem for 18 months, but continues to be a problem both in terms of vaccinations and masks.
Can you tell us, what does the science say about why Delta is more infectious and contagious than earlier variants?
Well, the virus itself, the original virus had some pretty impressive superpowers. And one was that it was fairly infectious, that the average person who got the virus would spread it to three other people, which is less than some infections, but more than many others. Delta is at least twice that. And the reasons are that the level of virus that gets built up in someone who's infected is substantially higher. At least from one study in China, it appeared to be 1,000 times higher. So the amount of virus that an infected person is shedding out of their nose and mouth is substantially higher than with the prior viruses. And then it really is just sort of a math and physics problem, that if you have more virus that's growing in your mouth and nose, and you exhale or cough or sneeze, and it goes out, then it's more likely that enough of a dose of virus is going to hit a susceptible person that they will become infected. And so it is as simple and as complex as that. It's just a virus that is better at its main job, and its main job is to stay alive by infecting other people.
How much of the spread that is currently happening across the country is the Delta variant?
The latest figures from the CDC show that virtually all of the virus in the United States is the Delta variant. In the beginning of June, when there were 10 cases a day in being diagnosed in San Francisco, Delta made up about 3% of U.S. cases. So it was just new on the scene. It had been seen, obviously, in India and then in the UK, but really was a trivial portion of the cases in the United States. And just to show how good it is at its job, within a couple of months, it had become the majority of all cases in the U.S. And now it's up, CDC estimates, above 95%. So if you are infected with COVID today in the United States, the overwhelming chance is that it is with the Delta variant.
Those of us who are vaccinated can be infected with the Delta variant and not know it, and yet we can still spread it. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's not changed from what we learned in March of 2020. It really was the first superpower of, and in many ways, one of the most important superpowers of SARS-CoV-2, the original virus, was that, you know, if you remember all of the stuff we did in the beginning, checking people's temperatures and asking a ton of questions about symptoms, that was really predicated on most viruses, where if you have it and you can spread it, you're symptomatic. And what we began learning early in the pandemic was this virus, one of its real powerful attributes is that's not necessarily so. Probably, you know, half the people who have it, are capable of spreading it, feel perfectly fine. And that makes it particularly dastardly because, you know, they don't know that they have a problem, and you don't know that they have a problem, and yet they have the virus. Now, many of those people will ultimately get symptoms, although not all will. Plenty of people never have symptoms at all and yet are capable of spreading the virus. With Delta, the chances that they will spread the virus during that early asymptomatic phase are higher because the chances of them spreading Delta spreading in general is higher. I don't know that Delta is any more likely to spread while asymptomatic than the original virus was, but because Delta is better at infecting other people, if you have Delta, an asymptomatic person is more likely to spread it to you than if they had the old virus, just because Delta is better at its job of infecting other people.
And how long can they spread it? How long are they infectious? It's so interesting when you think about the different situations that can play out. For example, I ran into a friend recently. I was wearing a mask. He wasn't. And he said, oh, I had Delta 3 weeks ago. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, I was in bed for a couple days, but I'm fine now. And I said, well, did you get retested? And he said, no. And I backed up immediately. And I was just thinking, how long is he infectious? Do we know?
He was probably safe. The answer to that question is not completely known. And of course, one of the things we've learned with Delta is it's a little bit hazardous to extrapolate from our prior understanding of the virus to assume it's exactly the same with Delta. But I think most of the evidence is that although it is much more, at least twice as infectious, it doesn't seem to be infectious for much longer. That's not the mechanism by which it is more infectious. Not that you remain infectious for 3 weeks. And our best understanding is that people remain infectious. Probably on the outer edge of it is probably about 10 days. And the problem with repeat testing is sometimes people continue to test positive because they have viral fragments that no longer really are capable of infecting people. So that is still an area of a little bit of uncertainty. But I would guess that if he was 3 weeks out, he was safe.
We have a question from Wendy, who writes, if Delta confers such a greater viral load, is it possible that even being outdoors is not safe without a mask? And have any studies been done for this question?
It's a terrific question. And the answer is there have been some documented cases of outdoor spread. They're pretty unusual. And I think most of us are going with the assumption that outdoors is not 100% safe. I mean, people sometimes treat indoors versus outdoors as outdoors just sort of magically safe. If you are in closed quarters outdoors, which you're sort of right next to someone, and let's say they're a foot away from you and it's windless and they're yelling, you know, I would see that as a situation where it would have a non-zero risk. The risk of catching it through an aerosol, sort of there's a virus infused smoke in the air, sort of like cigar smoke, would be relatively low, because outdoors that dissipates very quickly and sort of flies around in 100 directions, unlike an indoor space where it can build up. But one of the mechanisms of spread of any respiratory virus is a direct kind of ballistic hit, meaning it's not through it wafting through the air. It is, there's some virus, I hate to get a little gross, but there's some virus in someone's spit, mm-hmm. and they're talking at you, or they're singing, or they're yelling, and a little bit of that spit hits your nose or the back of your mouth or even your eye. And so I still don't wear a mask outdoors, but I am quite careful. I don't get into really close quarters with people. If people are talking at me, I'll sort of back up to give them some distance.
Because there are a lot of outdoor concerts happening, and a lot of them are very crowded. I've gone to one or two, and about 80% of the people are not wearing masks. And I wonder what your thoughts are about Lollapalooza. A lot of people were wondering what was going to happen after Lollapalooza, where 385,000 people attended over 4 days. We saw videos. I maybe saw two masks in the crowd. The trains were packed. And I wonder what you think about this, Dr. Watker, because the Chicago Department of Public Health Commissioner Allison Arwady took to Twitter to say, we're 2 weeks past the first day of Lolla and we're continuing to investigate. 90% of attendees showed their vaccination card, and then 10% have had a negative COVID test from no more than 72 hours prior to the festival. Of those vaccinated, 0.0004% reported testing positive, and of those who had a negative COVID test, 0.0016% have reported testing positive. What do you make of the data so far?
Yeah, I think if I was going to attend a big outdoor conference where people are going to be crowded and singing and shouting, I would wear a mask just to be on the safe side. I think in most of the outbreaks that we've seen, you know, when you look at what happened in Provincetown, sorry about the dog, by the way, that'll get better in a second.
That's okay.
When you look at what happened in Provincetown, when you look at what happened last year in Sturgis, they were big outdoor gatherings, but they had big indoor components. When people went and carefully traced where the infections happened, for the most part, they happened in bars and restaurants and in people getting together inside. So I still think that, hard to interpret all of those numbers, but I would expect that the numbers would be relatively low if the main contact was outside. Again, that said, if I were, you know, going to a big outdoor space where I'm really shoulder to shoulder with a ton of people, particularly if it's windless, I would feel more comfortable wearing a mask.
And there's also a huge difference between, for example, the Bay Area venues are requiring a vaccine card, whereas the Sturgis events did not. So how comfortable are you going to a concert, for example, or a venue that requires proof of vaccination?
Well, certainly more comfortable. It's tempered by a couple of things. One is we do know that vaccinated people are capable of catching and spreading the virus. That is a change from what we thought about the prior viruses. You know, one of the big announcements that came out probably in February after the vaccines came out was, you know, up until then we had this question. Yes, they really do prevent you from getting sick with COVID, prevent you from getting very sick with COVID, but do they prevent you from spreading the virus? And the answer came out, yes, they do. And so it meant that if you were in a crowd of vaccinated people, you could feel very, very safe. With Delta, that bet is off. It's the levels of virus that have been cultured from the throats of people who are infected with a breakthrough case, meaning they've been vaccinated with Delta, are quite similar to the levels of virus in unvaccinated people that have an infection. Now, you probably are a little bit less apt to spread because it looks like you clear the infection from your nose and mouth more quickly. But I think if you're sort of remembering a rule of thumb, the old rule of thumb that if you're vaccinated, you're not capable of spread is no longer what I think most of us believe. I think most of us believe you're probably less capable than if you got an infection unvaccinated, but you're certainly capable of a spread. So that's one thing. The second thing is how trustworthy is the vaccine card.
Right.
And, you know, when I go into a place and I know they've been checking for vaccine status, whether it's from, you know, you have your little CDC card in your wallet, which I do, or you have a version of it on your phone, I sort of go with the assumption that it's probably 90% accurate. I make up that number, but I think it's hazardous to say 100% of the people are not fibbing or not using a fake card. And so I think you act accordingly. I went to see Hamilton in San Francisco last week. The folks putting on the concert were incredibly generous and gave a bunch of tickets to many of us at UCSF who've been working on COVID, which I thought was wonderful. And it was everybody was checked for the vaccination status, and it was universal masking. And I felt safe doing that. I wore a double mask. You know, I think it's important to wear good masks these days, not a single ply cloth mask, but a double mask. And I kind of assumed that the vast majority of people were vaccinated. But I think we don't have a fully trustworthy vaccine checking system. So when you go into a place that's doing, quote, vaccine, you know, mandates and checking, I think you have to have in the back of your mind that that's an imperfect system. It's possible that someone's going to slip through, and therefore it's worth being a little more careful than you might be if you were 100% sure that everybody's vaccinated.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because frontline workers are having to deal with a lot right now to check these cards and then to decide whether or not they're fake. One man that I met, I said, "How's it been so far?" He said, "For the most part, it's been great, but we have definitely caught a lot of fake vaccine cards." And I was just looking, doing a news search here. Yesterday, the Washington Post reported that federal agents seized thousands of fake COVID vaccination cards destined for locations across the United States. So it's just really important to note that, as you did. Dr. Wadker, I'm also glad you brought up masks because I've noticed on Twitter that a lot of doctors are now saying that the masks that a lot of us have been wearing, these basic one cloth mask, is just no longer adequate. So what at this point is an adequate mask?
Yeah, I think the bottom line is that mask work, even a simple mask, is better than nothing. And they work partly by preventing you from spreading and partly by preventing other people from spreading. So I'm much more comfortable when everybody is wearing a mask than, you know, if I go and see, I'm about to go in a store and I see that people are not wearing their mask. A, I may not go in, or I may avoid the aisle where I see an unmasked person. But B, I'm going to be very careful to be wearing sort of heavy duty masks. So what does that mean? It means a single cloth mask is probably inadequate in the face of Delta. And the reason, as I said, is Delta is just so much better at spreading that the kind of mask that might have worked fine for the original virus may not provide you enough protection against Delta. What do I wear? When I'm wearing an N95, I wear a version that we use in the hospital, which is a tightly fitted N95 that, you know, leaves little dents in my face because of the tightness of the elastic. I will wear that in situations where I think there's reasonably high risk. So a cross-country plane flight, for example, where I don't know the vaccine status of everybody sitting around me, even though planes are reasonably safe and the air exchange is good, going to a place where I see a lot of unmasked people, I'm going to wear. And if I went to a part of the country where the prevalence of the virus was much higher, then I would be more inclined to wear even better and sturdier masks. The reason I don't wear it all the time is it's relatively uncomfortable to wear for long periods of time. And there are versions of the N95, the KN95 and the N94, that are also quite good and are a little bit more comfortable. So it's worth sort of snooping around for a mask that you are comfortable with that provides a lot of protection. But the evidence is quite good that you can get a lot of protection close to that of an N95 if you wear a surgical mask first underneath, and then on top of that, a good and fairly tightly fitting cloth mask. And that's what I generally do for day-to-day activities when I'm going into the Safeway or another store. I will wear a surgical mask underneath. The problem with a surgical mask, it's got a lot of holes along the top and the sides. And so a good, particularly double-ply or triple-ply cloth mask on top of that not only provides extra layers of protection, but it sort of seals in the outside rim of the surgical mask. And the combination gets you up to a level of protection that's pretty close to an N95. And that's what I wear most of the time. And I find it quite comfortable. If I have to wear it for 5 hours in a row, it's really no big deal. And I'm just struck as I hear all these conversations, mostly in other parts of the country, about how abusive it is to make people wear masks. You know, I often say it's not chemotherapy, it's a mask. It's really not that big a deal. And unfortunately, we've made it into a big deal, but it's really, you know, as a doctor, we wear masks all the time, and it is just simply no big deal.
Dr. Watker, do you all have enough PPE now?
We do, yes. It certainly was a struggle everywhere, including at UCSF in that first month or two. And unfortunately, the message got out to people that, you know, you shouldn't wear masks, in part to make sure there were enough masks for myself and my colleagues, you know, doctors and nurses trying to take care of patients. We didn't have enough. But the message then became politicized that the masks really don't help that much or you don't need them. At this point, there is plenty of PPE and more than enough masks available pretty much in every hospital in the United States. So the shortage is no longer a concern, nor is there a shortage of PPE that regular people can get from the store or get online. So shortage should not be a reason for not wearing a mask. And I am wearing a mask all the time when I'm in indoor spaces with people whose vaccination status I don't know. I went, you know, there were a couple of weeks in early June where the prevalence in San Francisco was so incredibly low that, and I was vaccinated and the vaccines were working incredibly well, that if I was running into a store for, you know, for a couple of minutes, I often wouldn't bother to wear a mask. But starting by mid-June, as the cases started to go up, as the evidence of how more infectious Delta was began to accumulate, and as there began to be some concerns that maybe the performance of the vaccines might be slipping a little bit, I went back to indoor masking everywhere. And I just saw a study that Stat News did, where they interviewed about 30 public health experts. I was one of them, asking, you know, what they would do. And pretty much every one of them says when they go to indoor spaces, unless it's a small group of people whose vaccination status they're 100% confident in, that we all wear masks.
Wendy has a good question about masks. If they're so important, why isn't the government giving out masks? Why is it so hard to find an N95 or KN95 in a retail store instead of online, where you need a charge card or internet access to get the mask?
Yeah, I mean, the government did think about that early on when the Biden administration started. They actually considered going ahead and sending 3 masks or so to every person in the United States. I think just they decided that would not be the most cost-effective strategy, that most people that wanted access to masks had access to masks. And as I said, you know, the N95 or the KN95 are fine. Most people, I think, are able to find them somewhere. But if you can't, you can certainly go into any store and get a surgical mask and get a good double-ply or triple-ply cloth mask. If you're wearing those two things, surgical mask first, closest to your face, cloth mask on top, your level of safety is excellent. I'm perfectly comfortable. When I'm in the hospital seeing patients, now most patients have been tested before they come in, so I know their COVID status. That is what I'm wearing when I'm going into most rooms. It's only when I go into a room of a patient who I know has COVID or has tuberculosis or another very infectious respiratory infection that I switch to the N95.
When you say surgical, are you talking about those blue masks that are handed out when you go into a hospital or a medical clinic?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Let's take one call before we go to break. Let's go to Lauren in San Francisco. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
I was calling to ask if, since Delta seems to be predominant now, if we should follow the same last guidelines that were talked about for handling groceries and food deliveries.
All right. Thank you for that. Dr. Watker, were you able to hear Lauren?
Yes. It's an interesting question. It's certainly, we all remember those first couple of months of, you know, either quarantining or washing the mail and the shopping bags. Over the course of the first year, there was really no evidence of spread from surfaces. And although Delta is much more infectious, there remains no evidence that Delta can spread from surfaces. This is largely a matter of an aerosolized virus. And the reason that Delta is more infectious is that the person who has it is harboring more virus in the back of their throat and the back of their nose than they would have if they had been infected with the prior virus. But let's say they somehow were, you know, in the region of a piece of mail or a shopping bag, the amount of virus on that does not seem to be sufficient. So it's not in aerosol form. It's on the paper or on the surface. It doesn't seem to be sufficient to cause spread. So I haven't changed my practice at all. You know, I got done with quarantining the mail and the stuff that came from FedEx, and cleaning the shopping bags maybe 2 months into the pandemic, stopped doing that. And I've not restarted doing that. And I don't think there's any reason to.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. Today, we are taking your questions about COVID, about the Delta variant, boosters. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. We're joined today by Dr. Bob Watker, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Watker is also author of The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. This is your call. We'll be back after this. This is your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about the recall election of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Ballots began arriving in the mail this week. You have until August 30th to register and vote by mail, or you can register and vote in person on September 14th. Gavin Newsom's political future depends on turning out enough Democrats to counter Republican enthusiasm. So we'll find out who's behind the recall. A lot of money is being thrown into these races. We'll also talk about that. And then Thursday, we will discuss the reconciliation bill. This is so important. This reconciliation bill would actually increase Medicare by adding dental, vision, and hearing, provide universal pre-kindergarten, tuition-free community college, a lot of important things in this bill. We'll discuss it Thursday. Friday, we'll talk about coverage of Afghanistan. Today, we are answering your questions about COVID, the Delta variant, boosters, any questions you have. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or send us a tweet at yourcallradio. We're joined today by Dr. Bob Watker, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Watker has been tweeting nonstop since COVID began. You can follow him at Bob_Watker, W-A-C-H-T-E-R. Dr. Watker, before we get back to calls, let's talk about what we're learning about breakthrough infections. At this point, what really stands out for you? Because I'm noticing that we're hearing media stories, like, for example, NPR reported on a family of three who went to Disneyland, vaccinated, they did all the right things, they ended up getting COVID, and sadly, the dad has cognitive issues. He cannot write a sentence. And so those are just devastating stories to hear. But, you know, how do you think we should be thinking about breakthrough infections?
Well, it was inevitable that there would be some, you know, when the vaccines first came out and the studies about the vaccines in November, if you recall, first Pfizer announced, then Moderna announced, and they said we're, you know, 95% effective in preventing symptomatic infections and close to 100% effective in preventing hospitalizations and deaths. And everybody I know who was following this literally jumped for joy. I couldn't believe how good these vaccines were. But even there, if you're vaccinating 180 million people and the breakthrough rate, they're 95, not 100% infected, you're going to have hundreds of thousands of vaccinated people who get symptomatic COVID. And that will be amplified, of course, because to the public and to the media, each one will be a little bit of a story. It's like, oh, I thought the person was safe. Now, what we have seen is that 95 number is no longer the number. And that is probably a combination of two things. One is Delta. It's because it is more infectious. It's better at evading the vaccines. Now, the vaccines still work quite well against Delta, but not quite as well as they did against the original. And the second, and this is where the booster question comes up, is that we are beginning to see some evidence that the vaccine effectiveness wanes over time. And that was the reason why you heard today that the administration announced that they're going to be giving boosters to people 8 months out from their first vaccine. So my shots were in December and January, and I'll be eligible for boosters once they come out. So that number, rather than 95% now, is hotly debated. It might be 80, it might be 70, it might even be a little bit lower than that, which means you're going to see a lot of breakthrough infections. Most of them will be very mild. The vaccines still are working quite well in preventing people from getting really sick, going to the hospital, going to an ICU, and dying. But we are seeing people who do get sick enough to go to the hospital, partly because the breakthrough infections will be most common in older people whose immune system wasn't as good to start with. And so it's a complicated situation. The vaccines still work really well. You still are massively safer if you're vaccinated than if you're not. But breakthrough infections, you know, in the beginning, CDC said they are rare. I don't think they are rare. They're uncommon, but you'll hear about them. Most people will recover fine. A small percentage of people do appear to have symptoms that last for many weeks. And so it's one of the reasons why, even, you know, as a fully vaccinated person, I still am pretty careful, because I still would really prefer not to get COVID, because I can't say for sure that I'll have a super mild case. Maybe I'll have a case where I can't taste for a month or get brain fog. And as I said earlier, we now know that vaccinated people who get infected are also capable of spreading the virus. So those are two good reasons why vaccinated people should still be careful. And when their number comes up, probably should go ahead and get a booster.
And it's important, as you noted, Dr. Watker, to say that less than 5% of the people being hospitalized and dying today are fully vaccinated. I mean, it's so devastating, Dr. Watker, to watch the cable shows and just see people in bed who can barely talk, who say, "I regretted not getting the vaccine." Or in some cases, you know, someone who lost a partner or a mom or a dad or a grandparent saying, "I wish I had been vaccinated. I wish my husband, my wife had been vaccinated." I mean, it's just devastating to see this in August of this year. I mean, a year and a half out.
It's terrible and sad. In some ways, you know, every person who gets really sick, and obviously every person who dies, is immensely sad. In some ways, there's a different kind of sadness now, because you know that by and large it was preventable.
Right.
And, you know, why they didn't get the vaccine, whether it's their own personal belief or where they get their information from or people politicizing all of this, you know, who knows? There are a lot of people have a lot of different reasons. But, you know, as surprised and shocked as I have been by the Delta variant, probably been more surprised by the idea that we have now politicized vaccination, that we've politicized masks. And yes, when someone comes in the hospital sick with COVID and they ask for the vaccine, we tell them it doesn't make any difference at this point. The vaccines, you know, take a month to 6 weeks to work and have absolutely no value once you're already sick. So it really is immensely sad, because most of these sicknesses and deaths were totally preventable.
Mm. Dr. Watker, we're getting a lot of questions about what we know about people who've been vaccinated who get breakthrough infections and long COVID. Do we have any data on that?
We have one piece of data, and it's not very satisfying because it's really from a small study. So here's the issue. You're fully vaccinated. You do get infected because there are breakthrough cases, and we're hearing more and more of them. And the question is it going to be a mild case like the cold or like a flu and go away, in which case you probably will wish you didn't have it because you felt crummy for a few days. But at the end of the day, no big deal. And it actually boosts up your immune system pretty good. So you're probably even safer against another infection. Or are you going to have a case that whose effects linger on for more than, usually the definition of long COVID is more than a month? The only information we have about this, in part because the CDC chose a few months ago not to track all breakthrough cases, they just track hospitalized patients and deaths. The only information we have comes from Israel, where we've gotten a lot of information that we use on knowing what happens after vaccination, because Israel was the world's poster child in getting people vaccinated quickly. And they've got a very good healthcare system and very good information system, so they can track people very well. They did a study of healthcare workers in one of their very large healthcare systems and found that a small but meaningful percentage of patients got breakthrough infections. And then they asked those people 6 weeks out, they went back to them and said, how do you feel? And 19% of the people with breakthrough infections continue to have symptoms. Fevers, headaches, brain fog, not thinking clearly, still couldn't taste or smell very well, things like that. So it was a relatively small study. We're talking about maybe 20 patients in that group who had these persistent symptoms. So I wouldn't make it's hard to go to the bank on that, but I think it is, you can go to the bank on a meaningful percentage of people who get breakthrough cases will continue to have symptoms, a month out from their infection. And it's another reason why, even as a fully vaccinated person, being a little bit careful, wearing a mask when you're indoors, particularly when you're around people whose vaccine status you don't know, or people who are not wearing masks, I think is a prudent thing to do.
And one more question about the booster. We've had your colleague, Dr. Monica Gandhi, on many times, and she said she wants to make sure that the decisions around boosters are not made by the CEOs of these vaccine companies. She wants the data or the information to be based on science. So what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Walker, now that we're learning that the Biden administration is coming out to say that you should get a booster 8 months after being fully vaccinated?
Yeah, they are basing it on science. So what was annoying was about a month ago, you had the CEOs of Pfizer and Moderna coming out and saying everybody's going to need boosters. And you know, for all we knew, maybe that was right. And they do get an inside look at some of the data a little early. But also, obviously, they're massively conflicted that a booster not also boosts their stock price, which boosts their compensation. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to be skeptical of that. And soon after the Pfizer CEO announced that, the CDC and FDA basically that afternoon came out and said, no, we don't think the data are good enough. So I'm glad they did that. Now you hear all of the federal authorities saying people are going to need them. And it's not because the Pfizer and Moderna CEOs are saying it. It is that they are looking at the data, data from the US, data from Israel, data from the UK, and they are seeing that the effectiveness of the vaccines in the face of Delta has gone down significantly. You still are much, much better off being vaccinated than not. But particularly for an older person who's at higher risk of getting infected and at higher risk of having a bad outcome, if the vaccine effectiveness wanes a little bit, they may go back into the danger zone. And if you recall, the first groups to get vaccinated were older people and healthcare workers. So I think there's a particular concern that if the if you have a 75-year-old who got their two shots in December and January, they are beginning to be in a vulnerable position where, and now the virus that they're likely to be exposed to is far more infectious than the one they would have been exposed to last year. So I think the science now is increasingly on the side of giving boosters. The question will be sort of a mirror of the question we had in December, January, who goes first, how to deal with the logistics. And then the other question, which is really a very difficult and important question, which is are we better giving a booster to someone or another person getting their first shot? And the answer is, at a societal level, you probably want more people to get vaccinated in the first place. But at least in the U.S., there's so much vaccine floating around that I don't think we have to make that choice. The choice you do hear about, which I think is a little bit of a false choice, is why are we giving people boosters in the U.S. when the vaccine rate in India or Indonesia or in Africa is so low? And I think we can do both. I think we can boost people who are vulnerable in the United States while also really leaning into increasing manufacturing and distribution capacity for the rest of the world. I think, you know, saving 100 million booster doses in the U.S. and seeing Americans who have been fully vaccinated begin to get sick and go to the hospital and some die, I don't think the country will tolerate that if the idea is we're using these doses to send to other countries. I think we've got to try to do both.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Bob Whatker, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and we are taking your questions about COVID. We've got a number of people who've been waiting patiently on the line, so let's go through as many as we can. Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I've been talking to an epidemiologist in Peru, and Peru's 91% Lambda strain, and now if you look at the WHO website, 29 countries have Lambda, and 44 states in the United States have Lambda. Why aren't people even discussing it very much other than in journal articles? I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thank you. Good question. It's a funny virus that sort of breaks out with different viruses in different places. You may remember prior outbreaks with different variants in South Africa and Brazil. Lambda does have some additional mutations that threaten, on more theoretical than demonstrated grounds, to be able to evade the immune system. So, of course, the scary scenario is a virus that's as infectious as Delta, but also better than Delta is at evading our vaccines or evading the immunity you get from a prior infection. Lambda may be that, but it hasn't really been proven to be that. Most of the concern about immune evasion comes from sort of a theoretical. When you look at where the mutations are, people worry and wonder about that. I don't think it's been fully proven. The most reassuring thing for the United States, although it doesn't help obviously in places like Peru, is at least so far, Delta is so infectious that it crowds out all of the other variants. You may remember there was a California variant that we worried about for a while. Delta outcompetes, it's basically a running race, and Delta is so much better at infecting people that it really crowded out all of the other variants. And at least so far in the United States, we are seeing reports of cases of Lambda, but no reports that show that Lambda is outcompeting Delta. So at least for the time being, it's looking in the U.S. like Delta is going to be the main variant that we have to worry about.
Are you concerned that that could happen if we do not increase vaccination rates?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think there's no, when we were talking about the original virus, we were always concerned, is there going to be a virus that's more infectious? And then Alpha came out and it was. And then we said, all right, that's bad enough. We're dealing with it. And then, but we can beat it back. And then Delta came out and it was. So there's nothing in the book of life that says that a new variant won't come out and be even more infectious than Delta, although many virologists believe that we may have reach peak infectivity, but you don't know what you don't know. And certainly there is some concern that a new variant will come out and be able to evade the vaccines better than Delta has. Delta does it a little bit, but not all that much. And yes, the more spread there is, every time there's a spread of a case, it gives the virus another chance to mutate. So our best protection is to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible, but we also have to protect the people who are vulnerable today.
Thank you for the question, Mark. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. A couple of questions. One, I got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine several months ago. There, I've been trying to find out from my local pharmacy where I got it whether there was a booster for that. They don't know at this point, so I don't know if your guest knows anything.
Yeah, thank you. Let me say a word about that. So I feel for the people who got J&J because all the discussion tends to be about Moderna and Pfizer because probably about 95% of the vaccines in the U.S. were Moderna and Pfizer. J&J began with a lower efficacy. It has not been well studied how well a booster works for J&J, but it has been well studied how well it works for AstraZeneca, which is a very similar vaccine. And the answer is it works quite well. The booster that you would get would be an mRNA vaccine, meaning you won't get another shot of J&J. Unlike someone who got Pfizer the first time, as I did, the booster I'll probably get is another Pfizer. You could argue that maybe it should be Moderna, but I think they're going to go with sticking with the same. for J&J, I don't think anybody believes the booster should be another J&J. I think the general practice would be to give you a single shot of either Pfizer or Moderna. I'm pretty sure that will become a recommended practice over the next month or two, so stay tuned. A fair number of the experts I know, and including some vaccinologists who got J&J, have already gotten a booster. They feel like the efficacy of J&J was low enough to start with that if it's waned a little bit, that the time is now to get a booster. That has not yet been approved, but my suspicion is it will be within the next couple of months.
Interesting. Can I follow up with another question?
Yes.
I do wear an K95 mask. It's not as tight-fitting as I would like it to be. So when I heard you talk earlier, I guess you were indicating that you could put a surgical mask over that mask, and that might be protective. Would there be any difference between wearing the surgical mask underneath the NK95 or in front of it?
Yeah, I don't know. So I wouldn't put a surgical mask over it because really what you want if you're going to try to pinch the sides, if it's really a fit issue, is the cloth mask because it's got more kind of elastic along the outer boundaries. What you're really trying to do is pinch things close. Whether there's any incremental value to wearing a second mask when you're already starting with a N95 or a KN95 or 94, I don't know. I've seen some papers saying that there is not much benefit to doing anything other than just wearing that single mask, but I haven't seen that tested anywhere.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you so much, Greg. Hope you're well. Let's go next to Carolyn in Alameda. Hi, Carolyn.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Dr. Wagner touched on my question, but I was wondering if a booster is recommended, would we be able to choose which booster that we wanted, and what are his thoughts on that? What does the science say?
Yeah, it's a little bit up in the air. I think that the FDA is going to approve, and it's going to take a few weeks, so we're not going to see boosters rolling out other than for immunocompromised patients. That's going to start soon, if not already. But for the more general population, I think we're going to start seeing it approved by the FDA probably in mid-September. And it will come out first in people who have gotten their shots more than 8 months ago, and probably just like in December, January, start with folks in nursing homes and in healthcare workers before it becomes available to the general population. It looks like the initial recommendation is going to be that you stick with the shot you got. You got Moderna, you get another shot of Moderna. You got Pfizer, you get another shot of Pfizer. I think the data are unclear on that. There's actually a little bit of data that says you might even be a little better off if you mixed and matched. You got Pfizer originally, you can now get Moderna. But I think they might be worried that maybe there's a theoretical benefit of that, but the risk of now being exposed to a different vaccine and maybe whether you're more likely to have a side effect from that. I think it's a little safer to stick with a vaccine you already took, so and you didn't have a reaction to it. But I think that's a little bit up in the air. That's probably subject to change. Once the vaccines are fully approved by the FDA, which is likely to happen in the next few weeks, your physician will have a lot more leeway in terms of what he or she recommends to you. So you will see physicians who've read the literature and say, I think you should get the other one, and may actually recommend that. And I'm guessing that pharmacies will go ahead and do that.
Thank you for that great question, Carolyn, and we'll stay on top of that one. Let's go to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise.
Hello, good morning. Thank you. Yeah, I have a seemingly silly question, but I walk up the street, the sidewalk, not far away from where I live, and somebody comes walking down the street. They don't have a mask on, but they may put on a mask when they're about just level with my head. Now, I'm going to walk into the space where they've been breathing. And I know that the virus doesn't stay alive in the air for all that long a distance, but I feel like that air has been coming, has been breathed. And people ought to have the mask on for a much longer distance when they're meeting somebody on the sidewalk. So I just wanted to ask what you think about it.
Yeah, I am really of the mode that outdoors is extraordinarily safe, that there have been vanishingly few, if any, cases whose documented spread occurred through casual contact, walking by someone on the street, running by someone on the street. It when you see outdoor transmission, it really is kind of direct ballistic spread from one person talking to or shouting at another person. So I don't wear a mask in that circumstance. I think if I'm walking on the street, you know, if walking the dog and someone's walking by me, I try to keep 2 or 3 feet distance at a minimum. And if you are choosing to wear a mask, and I think, again, I don't think you need to, but it certainly adds a little bit of extra protection. Then the concern that you should have about that kind of encounter is zero. There's really no chance that you're going to get infected from that.
Thank you. However, I don't see how people...
Thank you, Marie-Louise. Sorry about that. We're almost out of time. One more question, Dr. Watker. What are your thoughts about the usefulness of home tests for COVID?
They're fine. I mean, they are less sensitive. I mean, it depends whether we're talking about an antigen or viral multiplication test. But they're in general less sensitive for are you infected at all, but sufficiently sensitive for are you infectious? And there have been proponents of the idea that we're all going to have home tests. And every day while, you know, we finish brushing our teeth and then we go ahead and get tested and we see if we're in the clear. I just have always felt like that's a pretty unrealistic idea. You know, even if they're cheap, they're a buck or two a pop. And but if they seem to have pretty good test characteristics, and if you are have been exposed to someone or you wake up with a sniffle and you have a home test available, I think it gives you a good sense of whether or not you might be actively infectious. So it's fine to use. I don't think it's going to be, you know, there has been proponents of the idea that that would be the way we get ourselves out of this pickle, that everybody's got home tests. Everybody tests themselves every day. When they're positive, they stay home. And that's how we get ourselves through this. I just don't see that as a realistic alternative.
Dr. Bob Watker is professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. And if you'd like to follow Dr. Watker on Twitter, he tweets a lot about the latest science and where we are. He's at Bob_Watker, WACHTER. Dr. Watker, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for all of the great questions and emails. Sorry we didn't get to all of them, but we will definitely have Dr. Watker back to continue this important conversation. You can find some links at yourcallradio.org. We didn't have enough time to talk about children, but we'll definitely do that probably next week. We just got word that there were 2 COVID outbreaks at 2 Oakland schools. This is happening across the country. So this is a really important conversation that we'll have soon. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show, and we hope you can join us tomorrow. We will talk about the recall election of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.